Lorenz will be presenting today and later introduced more fully as our president. And Carol Bouffe is a psychologist in Northampton, and she's part of our outreach coordinator. There's Dan Grunwald, who is not here, and he captains our website and usually our technical setup. He does an extraordinary job on the website. The address is westmassyoung.org. That lists the upcoming lectures, and it also has past lectures, some transcripts, but also some video, audio. And today we have Megan Murphy right here, who's a documentary filmmaker, and she's volunteered to video today's presentation. Thank you, Megan. And that will be put on the website by Dan, so that can be enjoyed there. So with all these amazing pictures we're going to see. Oh, and Thayer Green, who's also a Jungian analyst, he's also on our board. He's not here this afternoon. And then Penny is an analyst in, she lives in South Deerfield, Penny Tarsic. She did that, Tarsic, thank you. She did a fabulous presentation last month about dream animals. That was really extraordinary. Or the, I guess it was the month before, but anyway. So we have, we usually meet on Friday nights, and we're doing an experiment, and this day, Sunday, is different. It's going to go for having it on a Sunday afternoon. So how many people are here to either of our lectures for the first time? Oh, great. Welcome. Great. Does having it on a Sunday, to any of you, does having it on a Sunday afternoon make a difference as opposed to a Friday?
Wow. Well,
that's good to know. Yeah. That's good to know. We have a sense that we'd like to mix it up a little more so it's not only on Friday night, so that's good to hear.
And email has been.
Yes, I have lots of helpers today coaching me. Afterwards, so we'll go from now until 4:30, which is longer than we usually do. Usually they're 2 hours, but feel free to use the to take care of your bodily needs whenever you need them. This bathroom has been designated by Smith as a men's bathroom, so don't worry about that. There's an, unless you want to, and then there's another bathroom over there, which is women's bathroom. It's just a little jog to the left and to the right. And there's water fountains out there too. So anyway, feel free, and there'll probably be a break at some point. And if you feel like you just like don't want to miss a single thing and you want a break, please let us know and catch Erica's eye. And we have email sign up here because we send out announcements, and then you can, you know, Dan does a beautiful job, and then you can forward those to your friends to encourage people to come and also remind yourself. And so that sign up is there, but you can also sign up on our website. So please do that. Spread the word.
Could you ask if anyone's here from the flyers that
yes,
you put out?
Sure. Yes. And we ask for a donation. I see the basket is nice and warmed up. Thank you very much. But if you can't make the, you know, $10 to $20, no worries. We use that to help get a tech person, and also sometimes we pay for the room, and also publicity and printing
and
our out-of-town speakers, too. We give them an honorarium and sometimes travel expenses. Thank you for your donations. The flyers, has anyone seen, we have this bay, orangey brown pumpkin flyer. Did anybody find out about this flyer?
That's the brochure. The other one. That's a brochure. It's on the door. The flyer's on the door.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Did anybody see this one? Was this helpful? We're trying to, you did? Okay, good.
How many?
We're trying to judge, you know, how to get the word out. And how about in...
How many?
Five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Thank you.
And then, how about in the papers, in the newspapers? Is that very helpful? You found out about it through the newspaper? Great. Okay, good. Well, then our publicity is working. I guess we need a mix. So I'll just tell you next month on Friday, February 6th, Anita Green will be presenting on contempt and shame. And just briefly, what she says is that shame is the most toxic and most human of the emotions. And contempt and shame are two sides of the same bipolar emotional dynamic, whether one is on the giving or the receiving end. So Anita is a PhD. She's a Jungian analyst and a Rubenfeld synergist and a graduate of the C.G. Jung Institute in New York, and she also teaches at the Jung Institute in Boston. So it's a gift to have Anita here, living here and in our community and making a presentation. So that will start at 7 in this room on February 6th. We do them on the first, except this one, we do them on the first Friday of the month. Anything else? Anything else I've forgotten? No? Okay, we're getting our business done. So Carol is going to introduce Erica.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Erica Lorenz. And Erica is a Jungian analyst. She's also a dancer and a former dance therapist, which matters. Presently, she is a training analyst at the C.G. Jung Institute of Boston, and she sits on their training board. Now, over the past 30 years, Erica has lectured and taught in the USA and Canada. She has what some people have, a kind of fountain of youth. So for all the wisdom and life experience, you don't feel this is a very wise, aged person. Oh, but you know what I'm saying. She's fountain, young, eternal. So I bring this up because I often say to her, she's kind of humble, low-keyed, and she doesn't really let people know how much she knows. So I'm saying this for her. presently, she is president of our very own Jung Association of Western Massachusetts, and we're really blessed. She's a resource. She has a private practice here in Northampton. I think she's just been here for 3 years now. So again, a resource to this community that we have some very experienced Jungians, because if any of you have followed the Jung Association, the old guard is now in their 80s and are retiring and passing on this work to the younger 70, 60-year-olds. I actually encourage you to go to Erica's website. It's a beautiful website and speaks very deep and inspiring way about the philosophy of the practice. So, in my opinion, Erica is a resource to our community. And by the way, you all know in this audience there's a tremendous resource. you know how much each of you do to contribute to the art, to the health, to the spirit of this unusual community we live in. And Erica fits in very well. She not only is very knowledgeable, she has a great deal of knowledge about that great body of Jung's work. And all those in the field who have followed him, and there have been many, I love Arnie Mandel, Estes, Marion Woodman, there's so many. Anyway, she also is a great resource for those of you who are interested in mythology. How about those of you who are interested in dream analysis? She, of course, has an enormous Santre collection, if any of you have used the Santre. Very powerful medium. And she donated this immense collection to Springfield College's art therapy department, which is a very generous gift, and she has volunteered her time to teach the students how to use that medium. The one last thing I want to mention is that she, again, I said she's a dancer, and she studied dance therapy and authentic movement. She was a dance therapist. She studied authentic movement in 1975 with Janet Adler, if any of you do authentic movement. And I was at the Boston Institute 2 years ago, and she did a authentic movement workshop, and I can say it was the best experience I've had in that medium. Also, of course, she works with active imagination, and I hope we'll get her to do a workshop in the spring. So, I think today, Erica brings us 2,000-year-old frescoes from Pompeii. And we have several people here who visited Pompeii recently, so I hope you'll share your experience with us. And the women's Dionysian rites at Pompeii. You know, I don't know if Erica knew, but those frescoes have inspired many dancers, Isadora Duncan being one. And we were thinking locally, because we're such a great community, that we might get a few people who are dancers to see what if the frescoes would inspire them, and also develop our understanding of sacred sexuality. So again, all of this intertwines, and Erica, I thank you so much for all you bring.
Well, good afternoon, welcome. I'm in a sacrificial mood today. I cut myself twice on my left hand. Anybody want to tell me what that means? How many people have been to Pompeii? How many people have seen the Villa of Mysteries in Pompeii? Aha, they're hidden, aren't they? You don't know where they are. How did you find them? Did you know they were there?
We just wandered off.
How many people wandered? You wandered off?
The regular ruin was on strike.
Oh, I'm going to end up at the Villa of Mysteries. That's good. Okay. Interestingly enough, this is Pompeii, the ruins of Vesuvius. Interestingly enough, after they rediscovered Pompeii and uncovered it, they moved all the precious art to a museum somewhere near. But they did not remove the frescoes of the Villa of Mysteries, interestingly enough. We can all understand why. Nor did they remove the beautiful little frescoes in the whorehouse, which is a wonderful... I actually have... I think the whorehouse is over there for you to look at. And just for your interest. And I brought back from Pompeii the slides that I'm going to show you, but also these wonderful plaques of the frescoes themselves that go over my bed. So,
yeah,
those
were I
have. Okay. My glasses. I also, I always, this is one of my favorite bibliographies that I've made up, if you're interested. It's, most of them are spiritual autobiographies of modern people, because we have a lot of spiritual autobiographies of ancient and well-known, Teresa of Avila, Buddhist, blah, blah, blah. But I've been very interested in modern people's spiritual journeys. And these are ones that I feel like are very earthy and grounded and very interesting. So most of them are that. Okay. What I'd like is I'd like a dialogue. I don't like to stand up here and talk at you. So if you can't see the screen, I suggest you move over because there's a lot of detail I'm going to go into. So please feel free to raise your hand, make a comment, ask a question if you don't know what I'm talking about, because sometimes I don't, so we'll work together. So first we want to talk a little bit about initiation. What is initiation? It can happen randomly. It can happen by somebody suddenly losing their job, losing a loved one, having a child. All those can be quite powerful initiations. My initiation, I remember when I went to be interviewed to train to be an analyst, I had a little dream before I went, and it was somebody said, you need to sing dithyrambs to yourself. And I had heard this word, and I thought I knew what it was, but I couldn't remember, so I looked it up, and it said, singing praises to yourself before your interview. And that was quite an initiatory process as I listened to Paul Winter's, the one that has all the Russian music, as I was driving across Texas to get to my interview. So that was quite an initiatory. So Carinye, who is a major mythologist, says the goal of initiation is union. So what are we trying to find union with in initiation? And he also says, the ceremonial transition from one state of being into another, which is imposed or undergone willingly. And Mircea Eliade, anybody know Mircea Eliade? He's also a very famous mythologist before Joseph Campbell. He says, initiation is equivalent to a basic change in our existential condition. We emerge endowed with a totally different being from that which we possessed before. So this is a very powerful transitional space in your life. And Eliade also says, it's the rite of passage from the profane to the sacred, from the ephemeral and illusory to reality and eternity. That sounds kind of Buddhist, doesn't it? In fact, I have a beautiful book over there of the Bung tradition in Tibet. It's a transition from death to life, from man to from us to divinity, and it's about attaining the center of ourselves, the center of our connection between the personal and the sacred. It's a consecration. Yesterday's profane and illusory experience gives way to new life, real, enduring, and effective. So if the initiation is successful, we come out with a whole new sense of ourselves, our old, I love the image of Kali who cuts off your head so we can get to another state of experience. And Jung, over and over and over again, I'm very grateful that my first work was really into the body and into the descent into the body through authentic movement and active imagination. And I would like to do a workshop maybe in February, so keep your eyes open. What was I saying? Descent into the body. Because Jung says over and over and over again through the collected works and through these very heady, right, if anybody's tried to read the collected works, very heady collected works, that nothing can happen unless we experience it. We can talk about it all we want. We can look at all the archetypal manifestations in all cultures all over the world. But if we don't experience something through in the body, psyche, mind, body coming together, there is no change. There is no transformation. Okay. Sylvia Pereira, here's another book. I've put some books, some of my favorite books. I have so many.
Sylvia Britton Pereira, anybody know her? Yeah, she's one of my favorite analysts. She's the whole lot. She trains in New York. She wrote Descent to the Goddess, which is about Inanna, the Sumerian goddess. So she says, in Descent to the Goddess, that the initiation, and even though we're in this particular fresco's Dionysus is the one of the main characters, it's also about Ariadne, his spouse. So she's talking about, in this particular case, that our descent, and this is particularly important for us modern people who are very in our heads, in the left brain, who tend to move in a masculine patriarchal world, though that we hope that's changing. And that one of the main things, Jung did not, in the whole Red Book, his initiation through the entire Red Book, he never ascended. His journey was always to descend. And he felt, he didn't do that on purpose, it just happened. But from that, what he realized and what he saw in dream after dream after dream of clients was that in our culture, we need to descend into the underworld, into the unconscious, into the body, into the sensuous, into the underworld reality, into the goddess. Pereira says to me, the initiation is to meet the goddess in her primal reality. This inner connection is an initiation essential for most modern people in the Western world. Without it, we are not whole. The process requires both sacrifice of our identity as spiritual people of the patriarchy and a descent into the spirit of the goddess, because so much of the power and passion of the feminine has been dormant in the underworld, in exile for 5,000 years.
Will you just read that one more
time? Yeah. I know, these quotes, they just go by fast, don't they? So, the initiation is to meet the goddess in her primal reality. This is on page 7 if anybody wants to look it up. This inner connection is an initiation essential for most modern people in the Western world. Without it, we are not whole. The process requires both the sacrifice of our identity as spiritual people of the patriarchy and a descent into the spirit of the goddess, because so much of the power and passion of the feminine has been dormant in the underworld, in exile for thousands of years. Okay. So that doesn't mean we leave the masculine, whatever that is, behind. That means that we just need to bring it back in balance, correct? Okay. So we have a lot of incredible... I'm using Linda Fierce David's, you can get this on Amazon, Women's Dionysian Initiation, because she goes into such beautiful detail of each step in the initiate's process. So Pompeii, the Villa of Mysteries, which is the house of, it's the house of an Orphic cult. It's an Orphic tradition. Orpheus, who was a god of the underworld. And they initiated aristocratic women from 31 BC to 14 AD. Pompeii had an earthquake in 63 AD, and Mount Vesuvius erupted and totally covered it in 79 AD. And then they began excavating it, and the Villa of Mysteries was rediscovered in 1910. The interesting thing about the Villa of Mysteries is there's this room that you will see where the frescoes are was barely touched by Mount Vesuvius, as well as a few other things. But if you go to Pompeii, they have actually created statues on the ground of people that are in agony because they're suddenly being killed by the ash of the volcano. So it's quite a powerful place to be. And way back in a corner, and I think, though I may be wrong, that may be the Villa of Mysteries. I'm not sure. I don't know quite where it is on the map. But it's actually been refurbished. A lot of the rooms have been redone as opposed to a lot of the other ruins, so it's very interesting. So the Villa of Mysteries, you'll see there's one part of the Villa of Mysteries, the frescoes that did get damaged, which is the inner sanctum where Dionysus and Ariadne are, which I think is very interesting. You cannot see them. So So I think that's very, that fits in with the initiation that we're talking about. Okay, let me go to, so let's talk. This is the first slide, but let's talk a little bit about Dionysus and Ariadne, because they're the main god, they're the god and goddess union that we're moving towards. So Dionysus is a very, very old god. He comes from many different places in the Middle East, and eventually is in the Orphic tradition, is the one we're talking about. He's the ruler of the dead and souls. He is the son of Zeus and Persephone. That's not quite right. I'll get to that. In the Delphic oracles, in the Temple of Delphi, it was originally Dionysian, and then it was taken over by Apollo in the mythology. But then it became that they became in balance, and Apollo is the sun, the light of the sun, the powerful light of consciousness, and which contains and works with the Dionysian energy, which is the light of winter. Apollo is the light of summer, the bright, and you can imagine in Italy and the Middle East that sun versus the winter sun. So now is the perfect time to talk about the Dionysian descent. Okay, so, and there are a number of different traditions. These mythologies move around depending on the area and stuff about who begat who and who did what and all these things. So he is the huntsman, and he hunted wild creatures. He is about madness and delivers us from delusion. He dismembers and we are reborn. He's a typical savior god, and of course Christ is a descendant of all these savior gods that happened before. Okay, so in the Orphic tradition, actually he is the son of Zeus in the form of a snake and Persephone. There are other things. And the Titan, Hera, who's always jealous, of course, of Zeus, has the Titans, who are the first beings before us, the first beings who are sort of monstrous and very primal, tore him apart, and he shapeshifts from a kid to a deer to a bull, and they tear him apart and they eat him. And Athena saves his heart. Good old Athena. She's always there saving somebody. And Zeus kills the Titans with a lightning bolt, and they become ashes, and we come from the ashes of the Titans. So we have the spark of Dionysus in us, because we have that piece from the Titans, which is the primal energy, and then the spark of the dark midnight sun, the divine energy. And Zeus is hidden in, Zeus hides Dionysus in his thigh, and then he delivers him from his thigh. And he gives him, he puts him in Semele, a god, he's part goddess, part human, so she's a human divine figure, and she births him. He puts it first, he's in Zeus's thigh, and then Semele takes him and gives him and births him. So Semele, so Otto says Dionysus is the divine being. Basic nature is madness and inherent in the world itself, not deranged, not a disease. That's the kind of madness we're talking about, the passion, the fire, the inner fire. Dionysus is companion to his most perfect health. Life, when it overflows and goes mad in its most profoundest passion, is intensely associated with death. It is life. And if we think of Vesuvius, that's an image of life gone to its extreme, fiery nature, its passion. He is the creative principle, and He shines from the depth. He's the unexpected. He overtakes us. He's a little bit like Hermes. Hermes is more the trickster. Dionysus is more of a grave figure. But they both are very irrational and erratic, and you never know when you're going to get hit by Dionysus. Eventually, he did become god of the wine. And the wine is that blood, that representation of the blood in us. He's the shuddering. He's the irrational emotional events that well up. He's a light from the earth. And his heart is always alive. Athena saves his heart, remember? And renewal always comes. So we want to get, as a culture that's very sort of shut down, even particularly here in New England. I lived in Texas for 25 years, and I love the sort of primal, kind of chaotic, wonderful energy in Texas. But we need to bring back this energy. And I've also done a talk on redeeming the feminine erotic soul, which is sort of similar to this in a different way. So Ariadne, who is his spouse, is the daughter of Minos and Pasiphae, and she is very archaic and chthonic. And she is the brother of the Minotaur, the labyrinth on Crete, mm-hmm. where they had to, Daedalus, who created all kinds of things, he created Icarus's wings. He was a craftsman in the ancient mythological world. He created the labyrinth to contain this bull, the wild bull, which is a Dionysian symbol, the wild bull nature. And Ariadne was his sister. And Ariadne is human and divine, and her surname is Persephone. So in these mythologies, there's all this very interesting linkage and cross connection between these different energies is what I'm going to talk about. And she's untouchably pure and holy. All the virgin goddesses, Athena, Artemis, a lot of them are called virginal. That's not because they didn't have many lovers. It's because they are forever pure. The male, the partner doesn't take over their pureness. So Ariadne is one of those. And Ariadne, because she's connected to the bull, she belongs to Dionysus. But Theseus comes along to kill the bull. Theseus is one of the Greek heroes. And she falls in love with him, of course, and she helps him get out of the labyrinth. He doesn't know how to get out of the labyrinth. He would get stuck in the labyrinth. She helps him to get in, and he kills the bull, Minotaur, and she comes out, and she follows him. And he deserts her because he's in love with someone else. He deserts her on the island of Nexus when she is sleeping. And so she wakes up and she's in despair and despondent and wants to kill herself. And Dionysus comes out of the sea and he consummates his marriage with Ariadne. And Ariadne, she wants to die, so she thinks that Dionysus is the god of death, which he is. And so she thinks that she's dying, but in that union, she is resurrected. So there's all this dying and resurrection that is in every initiation in the world. That's a major piece of it. Yes?
It's interesting that when the Greeks went to Egypt and they interpreted the Egyptian religion according to their religious mores, they called Osiris Dionysus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, there are all these links. I mean, they're archetypal. This is the archetype, right? Because the same energies come up in different forms. Yeah, good. Okay. So she's resurrected by the Hieros Gamos. And Ariadne is very clearly visible. And Ariadne, in her despair, has lost contact with the light in the earth. The light in the earth. That's a key to this initiation. And the creative fire of our emotions. And she has repressed her soul. And when Dionysus comes from the sea, he's the light of the underworld, he's the light of the sea, he changes from a bull to a wine god on Naxos, so that's when he becomes a wine god. Okay, let's go to the frescoes. So, I'm going to point out a lot of things. There's so much detail in these frescoes.
So this is the first scene, and this is the initiate. It's a woman. But when we think of the initiation of the woman, let's not think of gender. Let's think of the initiation of the feminine in all of us. Okay. So this is the feminine aspect being initiated. And Jung says, experience, not books, is what leads us to understanding. So the initiate is here, and her hand is just really relaxed. This is her right hand is very relaxed on her hip, just being relaxing and being ready. And she has a veil, which begins to separate her from the outer world. So she is preparing to go through the initiation. The veil separates us and makes us go inward. She is crowned with myrtle. Well, over here she's crowned with myrtle, sorry. Wait, okay. She is dressed as a Roman matron. And here, the little boy who, in some other understanding of the initiation, somebody thought the little boy is the one who's being initiated. He has the boots of Dionysus, and he's reading the rites. He's reading the initiation rites. And he's very anxious. He's very anxiously reading them. And this is the priestess who's going to oversee the initiation. She's holding the scroll of the rites in her hand. And the initiate lifts the cloak from her breast, from her left breast, which is her heart, which is that part of her which is going to be fully initiated, is our heart. And she does not speak. She is silent. The initiation is not about words, it's about silence. And then we move along, this is the beginning, to this is the initiate now, with a wine-colored drape. She looks pregnant. She's beginning to look pregnant, which is what an initiation is. We become pregnant with the god or the goddess. And she has the crown of myrtle, which is has to do with Dionysus. And she's carrying the sacrificial. There's always something that's sacrificed. So in ourselves, we're sacrificing something, which is generally some old view of ourselves or some way in ourselves that does no longer works, that we hold on to, and that gets ripped away, gets dismembered. And these are the honey cakes, which are the sacrificial food. And she holds in her left hand the laurel branch. The myrtle and the laurel branch are two of the main herbs that have to do with, or plants that have to do with this initiation. Okay. Now, in some versions of initiation, there's a snake that they actually put through the clothing of the initiate as a symbolic gesture of the primal energy that comes through. And the snake, which is one of the most primal animals, is about the agitation of emotions. So when we step into a place of initiation, begin to step towards a place of deep, deep transformation and change, we often get agitated. We often get anxious. And we think that in our Western world, we think, oh my God, I'm anxious. But that could be something that's really wanting to burst forth from our unconscious. And we feel this fear and hope at the same time. When we're faced with the numinous or with the sacred or with something that the unknown, we're filled with two things, fear and anticipation and excitement. So when we have those two emotions, we're beginning to be in the right place. And at this point, we're sacrificing the human to enter into the temenos or the sacred space, to allow the ecstasy to recognize the power, to connect with the power of the god or goddess that seizes us. So
let's go to the next one.
The initiate has arrived, Does anybody have any thoughts or questions as we're going along here? Sure.
I'm curious about your interpretation about the person being seated as a woman. That's Roman Aramaic.
Which one? Whoops, sorry.
Well,
she's the priestess.
Okay.
It is. It's Italy. It looks like a toga, but if you see, there's also a piece of robe here.
Okay.
So, yeah. Any other thoughts as we're talking about this? And keep thinking sort of those moments in your life when you've been gripped or seized by something that you can't understand, that's both enlightening and scary at the same time. Yes?
I just wanted to pause and ask if you had any comments on the fact that when she's moved through and she's present with appreciation, that this is when she actually engages with us.
That's a good question. I actually, to me, she's sort of looking back a little bit. You know, and this is the door that she comes through, okay, which is important, because she has to bend down. And in many, many initiations, you have to go down into the cave, you have to bend down, you have to go low, you have to get lower to the earth, okay? So, yeah, I think she's sort of looking from where she came. Okay. Any other thoughts?
Well, is that a young woman that's there or a young man? I mean,
It's a woman.
Okay, it's a tiny person.
Oh, the little boy. It's a little boy.
That's a little boy.
Yeah, that's a little boy.
I guess my glasses aren't seeing that.
Yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, these are old, ancient frescoes.
Okay.
And actually, what's also very important is this Pompeii red.
Yeah.
Isn't it gorgeous? Yeah. It's much better when you're there. It looks so vivid. And to me, this is about, what is red about? What is the blood? What is red?
Passion.
Passion?
Passion.
Uh-huh. Anybody else?
Courage.
Courage.
Life and life.
Life and death. You bleed out when you're dying, mm-hmm. and you bleed out when you're giving birth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts about blood? And you can't see it, but on top of this, you can see it in the frescoes that I have. On top of this, there's a what's called a meander. It's a little bit. It's a winding. This border,
mm-hmm.
kind of winding. That's the way the initiation goes. It's not straightforward for everybody. It's very important. An initiation, no matter what the ritual is, has to be unique. You can't just copy somebody else. You go into the ritual and you discover what you need to discover in the way you need to discover it. That's the Jungian way. Okay, so here our woman has arrived at the altar table with her cakes, and the ritual begins to be underway. The priestess, this is a priestess that's overseeing this particular step, is elevated on this block, so she's higher now. She also has the crown of myrtle right there. And she holds laurel over the bath. This is the holy water that is blessing the laurel, and then she puts it in the basket. And this is another younger priestess who's doing the rite of the holy water. Now Dionysus is a god of water, actually, god of water and fire. So that's an interesting combination, isn't it? We'll get to that a little later. So the high priestess lifts the cover of the basket, which is covered at this point, again with that purple color. So we're getting into the dark purple initiation color. And she lifts it, and this is an embodiment of the Great Mother, of the goddess. Okay, the priestess is an embodiment of the goddess. And the snake that we mentioned before, of course, is also the light hidden in the Great Mother, the light hidden in nature. That's what we're looking for, is the light
hidden, not the solar light, not the light of the celestial light. We're looking for the light in the earth. We're looking for, the alchemists would call it the natura scintillae, the light in the darkness, the sparks that come out of the unconscious that startle us and illuminate us. Yes?
I'm just wondering, like, I know pigments fade over time. Was that purple originally a different kind of purple? Like, or say, like, was it that orchid color?
Well, I can't tell you that because I wasn't there, but I imagine the whole thing has faded over time, but it was definitely purple. Yeah, because that's an important color.
That would be sending your kid to college worth of cost us that road.
That's a good point. It's also a color of royalty.
Yeah.
In most mythology.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the west.
Okay. Yeah, in the west. Yeah. Go ahead.
Things were more blue in the past fresco, and now they're more purple. Is that?
Well, this is purple, but it's been.
That's just time fading.
Yeah, I think that's time. Yeah.
You're moving forward. Things are deepening.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the cake, which is edible, is important. I mean, the religions, the consecration of the cake, of the sacrificial whatever we are that's being eaten, it's so we'll digest it. We take in the God is to digest. And to digest it into our lives, which is a very powerful part of the initiation, of course. Okay. So the thing that we have to remember in these initiations is it's a very slow process. Nobody really knows exactly what happened in this initiation, exactly what happened to the initiate, or how long it took for them to go through, or how they prepared for it. When I was there, there's a hall on the other side of this wall that, and there's a very small room, and it sort of, people think that that's where the initiate stayed solitary for a period of time before they went through the initiation themselves. So the silence and the solitariness is a very important part of this.
Can I go forward for a minute? This is actually a very important picture, because this gives us an image of, as she's progressing, the back, of course, which is the inner sanctum, and you can see where Ariadne and Dionysus got smushed by the earthquake or by the Vesuvius. And then, so when she turns the corner, there's a very important, this was done very intentionally. The pictures were done in sequence very intentionally like this. So.
Okay. So. So here we have, so she's moving along to the consecration of the sacrificial food, and then the next piece we begin to see Silenus with his lyre. And this goes back, of course, to Orpheus, who calls the beings from the dead, and music is the music of the spheres, the Pythagoras, and the music of our unconscious and the emotion. And so Silenus is the good shepherd. He's the teacher of Dionysus. He's a later version of Pan, who is the nature god. He now is the priestly, as you see, he has the purple robe that's just partly on him. He is the priest part of this initiation. He's singing us into the initiation. And he's half naked, so that when you're half naked, you're open to the divine. So he's more and more, we're slowly moving towards the sacred temenos, the divine. And he's originally a fountain spirit with wisdom. He's a mediator,
And he's the feminine, he's a very feminine aspect. If you see, he's not muscular, he's very soft. He sort of has this nice big belly. He sort of reminds me of the Buddha, the Buddha who has the big belly, who has
okay.
the, thank you, yes. So he's that kind of a figure. He's a connection between the masculine and the feminine in these rituals. And he is connected to the medicine man, and he's the readiness to receive, and he's the embodiment of the Tao. I'm going to read you a little piece of the Tao here. This is the 35th verse of the Tao Te Ching, Richard Wilhelm, and it's called The Life of Love. Whoever holds fast the great archetype, to him the world comes. It comes and is not wounded, in peace, in equality, and in bliss. Music and enticement. Indeed, they make the wanderer pause upon his way. Meaning comes forth from the mouth, mild and without flavor. Thou glancest at him and seest nothing remarkable. Thou listenest to him and hearest nothing remarkable. Thou reachest towards him and findest no end. Shall I read that again? Whoever holds fast the great archetype, to him the world comes. It comes and is not wounded in peace, in equality, and in bliss. Music and enticement. Indeed, they make the wanderer pause upon his way. Meaning comes forth from the mouth, mild and without flavor. Thou glancest at him and seest nothing remarkable. Thou listenest to him and hearest nothing remarkable. Thou reachest toward him and findest no end. So what does that conjure up for people? What does that say? Yes?
Water.
Water? Okay.
Yeah. Running water.
Hmm. Okay.
Eternal.
Eternal water. Isn't it interesting that as we begin to go into the right, we begin to discover nothing remarkable? Nothing. Yeah?
No, emptiness.
Emptiness. Right. That's the biggest, the most deepest mystery, isn't it? The nothingness, the emptiness, which is the place we most fear, which is the death.
Yeah. Emptiness of self.
What?
Emptiness of self.
Emptiness of self, right. Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah.
Peace.
Okay.
And the music guides the way.
The music, yes. Not necessarily words. It comes from the mouth, but it's not about thinking and words and the lyre.
Yeah. So maybe the mundane and the divine as one piece.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're moving towards, isn't it? Yeah. And this is the first time in the fresco that we have a mythical archetypal figure. We have priestesses and little boys and stuff before that. So this is a very important step into this next piece, because we're entering into the mythic realm. The lyre is from Orpheus, who brought Dionysus to Greece. And the lyre masters nature. It's a religious attitude that solves all conflict, the music. The soul goes beyond conflict. It's about surrender. It's about the music of love, the instrument of meaning, the emotion. And again, you cannot have transformation without emotion. Darn. Okay.
Could you tell me what's in the young priest? This is, it looks like it's either wrapped up in her robe or in her hand. What is that?
I'm not sure. I think that's just a gold. I think that's a gold stripe, or this might be again that going back to the initial the little thing that the boy was reading, sort of the scroll. Yeah. So that sort of carried up to this point, and then we lose it when slang comes in. Okay. Any other thoughts on this one?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this mythical creature is standing one foot on the block and one foot lower. So is he, he's the transition?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. You see, he sort of leaning on this pole, this post. And in Dionysian temples, there's always a spruce pole that they hang the mask of Dionysus, which we'll get to later, which is just empty. It's a mask of emptiness. So he's leaning on this, and this is, you're right, this is like a step into the next realm. Yeah.
What did you call him? What was his?
Salinas. I've heard it's Salinas or Salinas. Yeah. Go ahead.
We also see for the first time the introduction of the spiral going through the body.
Mm-hmm. You mean, yeah. That's an interesting point that we'll come to later. There's a lot of softness in these figures, aren't there? This mm-hmm. sort of roundness and softness and relaxed kind of, which we'll see a change in that as we go through. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to ask about that. The earlier painting where there was the pregnancy and being pregnant with the god of the gods and the agitation.
Mm-hmm.
If you could say a few words about what that experience is like.
For us?
Yeah, for us.
Well, I think any time we move towards something in ourselves that we don't want to see, or a change that of an old pattern that doesn't work anymore, and we're caught in the middle before we can shift, I think there's tremendous agitation. Depression. Jung spoke of depression as abaissement du mental, which means the consciousness is going down into the unconscious, so the energy, the libido is not for the outer world. So when we talk about somebody who's in a depression, they may be just needing to really be in the inner world. Now, if it's a chronic depression that goes on and on and on, they're stuck, obviously. But in the West, we see depression as a disease, right? But it's not necessarily a disease. It can be energy that's just gestating.
Mm-hmm. And then from there, from that pregnant part, there's this preparation mm-hmm. that is moving it towards the next phase.
Right, right, right. It's always a moving preparation, right? Can people begin to see little pieces of this, that little flashes in your own life that where things like this have occurred, or you can relate to the mythology of it? Because mm-hmm. that's the most important thing we want to get today, right? Not just these wonderful frescoes. Okay? So, yeah. So these are good pointers. Yes, go ahead.
As you look at the frescoes when you're there, are they moving too? Because, I mean, here we have a panpipe guy over there on the right. The
mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get to him.
Yeah, but I mean, as you're looking at them, you could be moving on further ahead and going back as you're doing it. You don't just, it's not so clear as the way you're kind of presenting it, which obviously you have to do.
Right. Right. Well, actually, the room, unfortunately, is cordoned off, which is too bad, so you can't enter into the chamber, and which to me is very sad. And you're also not supposed to take pictures, but I did a couple. but thank you for bringing that up, because the whole, if you saw the hall, it is sort of like a labyrinth in itself, or a meander, or a cyclical circumambulation going around the central self, the big S self, the sacredness of our being. It's sort of moving around it in various levels and ways. So, yeah, and in our lives, it does, transformation or initiation doesn't just go in this nice little pattern, does it? We get to a place and we go, and we get stuck and we run back and we go back and it's a process that goes up and down and cyclical. I talk a lot with my clients about, well, they're, you know, just if they're in a very deep place, there may be a wave that's very overwhelming. So it's a wave. So I use that image a lot, which is very Dionysian, the wave, or the flow of the lava. I had a client years and years ago, and I have permission to speak if I bring up any clinical thing, who had a very powerful connection to volcanoes, and she was very fiery and she was alcoholic, but she was a recovering alcoholic when I worked with her. And she would have these eruptions that she felt of emotion, And she had to learn how to deal, to work with that passion and the fire in herself, the fiery nature. So these are some of the images that that we can take with initiation. Can anybody think of an image from nature that really speaks to you about some initiatory or some process that you've been through that moves you along or that brings some energy up for you?
Phoenix.
A phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Being buffeted by waves last week.
Ah. Ah, that would have been cold. Well, it depends on where you are.
Fort Lauderdale.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anybody, because that's what we're looking for. This is all around us, really, truly. The world is a temenos. Yeah.
Watching things melt in a fire.
Just watching a fire. Just sitting there meditating and watching the fire. Yeah, yeah.
2 years ago, in January, cold grief,
mm-hmm.
and then in February there was like a deep cold and then a really fast warm, and if you walked along the Mill River here, there were huge sheets of ice that were just thrown off,
mm-hmm.
like in the night because of the flood of water
right.
that came, so you
yeah.
know, like that sudden going along, the quiet, the grief, the underneath, and then all of a sudden, like an eruption of water.
Right, and last year too, I remember in March, I think it was, we had that, suddenly it warmed up, there was ice, snow, suddenly we had that whole like 3 days of rain,
yeah.
and everything just, I mean, it was amazing. I have a friend who had an icicle this big from his roof to the ground, and when that happened, his basement flooded, of course. And that's sort of what an initiation like. Our basements get flooded. Okay, all right, so let's move. Hello, turn off your cell phones, please. Okay, so this is unfortunately, this slide doesn't clearly show this Linus, and then these are the children. This is what we become. This is what we need to become as we move through the initiation. The initiate, we're going to not look at this, okay, this is the next thing, so we're going to pretend she isn't there right now. We're just going to look at the Salinas, which is over here, and these fawns, and this is a goat. Where's his head? He's looking out at us. There's a goat. One is feeding, and then there's another one in here, so right here. He's looking out right at us. And he's playing the pipes, and he's feeding the goat. And this is the place that we regress to. We get back to the childhood, the child place. We have to be as children to enter the kingdom of heaven. We have to allow that natural innocence, that curiosity, that freshness, that vulnerability to be there in order for us to stop thinking about it and get into it. Right, exactly. The animal nature, which is our animal body. I talk a lot about the animal body. And the pipe is an instrument of Pan, of course. And let's see the poem. And there's an Orphic hymn. It says, "Friends of souls inspired by the God, enraptured one, living in caverns, thou playest the harmony of the world with jesting song of the flute, tending the race of men over the immeasurable earth." So that's the pipe. So anybody have any feelings about as we shift from the place of the human into the mythical and the place of the animal nature? Anybody have any sort of feelings of what that feels like, a moment in your life when you shifted into that total innocence and ability to just be childlike?
Like, it feels to me like almost total ecstasy, because you've got, the music is playing, it could be going faster and faster. You've got the animals there, our animal nature, and mm-hmm. so you're into the subconscious, you're into the body, so mm-hmm. what's next?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this is a very quiet scene, isn't it? Ecstasy is a little intense. So it's sort of a quiet thing, sort of a going into that animal, gentle goats and kids and children. It's kind of a more quiet than the true ecstasy that we're going to get to.
It's a petting okay. zoo.
What?
It's a petting zoo.
A petting zoo. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And I feel that kind of peacefulness when I'm with my dog and my cat, and they're in this place of connection, or what I perceive as connection with everything. It's not narrowed down to the human-to-human realm or to the mental realm. It's this inclusiveness that they put me in on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I go. So there's an innocence that I get inducted into.
Right.
Sharing
that time. Right. Yeah, yeah. I keep telling my friends that my cat is my meditation teacher. Mm-hmm. I just watch her. I watch her watching the birds. She's totally present. She's totally intent. She's totally focused, but she's totally there. She's not anywhere else. So that's sort of the intention that we need to get to, this sort of singular, present day, not past, not future, just here I am. Right? Yeah, Laura.
I think, too, if this comes in an audience is anticipating, you know, there's this quiet before mm-hmm. performance begins, people that are coming down into a neutral place of innocent openness to something that has been.
Yeah. Yeah, and also as a performer, you know, there's this energy that starts to happen, but you get this real focused place. Right? My father, one of the most beautiful things my father ever said to me was that if before a performance, he was an organist, before a performance, if you didn't get some energy and get a little scared and, you know, get focused, you wouldn't have the focus. It wouldn't come through you. So, yeah, but, yeah, go ahead.
I don't know what comes later, but in more present Western initiations, like in psychotherapy or mm-hmm. shadow work, you have to go through fear and anger and rage and grief, but this is so far so ephemeral and mm-hmm. lyrical and sweet
mm-hmm.
and not that people don't find that place, but it's often we go through this.
Don't worry, we'll get there. So I just want to go back for a second to finish that. It is interesting. So here we, the human, the little boy, the cakes, the whoops, I went back too far. The women, the, you know, we're setting it up. We're sort of setting up the therapy space in a way. And here we still have the human and the priestess, and then we begin to get into the mythical. We begin to get into that open mysteries. We begin to open ourselves, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just thinking about the Tao quote you read and also the getting rid of the words having less significance
mm-hmm.
and how that relates to this part where the animal.
Right. Yes. Very good. And but this is a very important step, isn't it? Because it's from the normal mundane reality, everyday reality, into the mythic space, which it happens, we hope, in most therapy sessions. We sort of get into that meditative inner space, and the words can disappear. So here we're getting into the animal nature, and then we spill the water.
Erica?
Yeah. Go ahead, Carol.
I just want to mention too the importance, I think, of touch.
Mm-hmm.
That the other is nurturing, feeding, but they are against his body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think particularly, I believe, in a lot of the Western culture, there's a taboo against touch.
Mm-hmm.
Touch has become sexualized,
right,
for commercial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I don't think, and I'm working in therapy with people, you know, many therapies prohibit touch,
mm-hmm.
physical closeness now in the West, and how to restore the nurturing, innocent, healing aspects of touch, I think, is an interesting theme.
Yeah, I think that is important, but I don't think it, yes, and touch is very important, and it also, I
don't think they would have a problem with it.
No.
I mean, in their time, that's the natural thing there, and I just want to say, there is, you know, that's natural right there.
And I think talking about touch, but also talking about touching your own, not literally necessary, but necessarily, but possibly literally, of touching your own body, of coming into your own body and listening, you know, whatever that is. And I think the clothing speaks something of the openness and the closedness and the veiledness and the dressed and the undressed and the animal body, yeah. So when I did authentic movement for years and years and years, I remember one time I was very ill, actually, and I went for a 5-day retreat. And Janet said, "Are you sure you should be here?" And I said, "This is exactly where I should be." And I curled up, not in the middle of the room, but pretty sort of in the middle of the room of 18 movers. Nobody touched me for 5 days. Everybody had their eyes closed, pretty much. Nobody touched me for 5 days. And I felt the most healing sleep. And what I felt was that I was in a burrow. I was held in a burrow under the ground. And all I was curled up on the floor, resting and sleeping and resting and sleeping. And I came out of that in a lot of ways, having turned a corner in walking pneumonia is what I had. So, and at one point, everybody was sort of on the floor. I had my eyes closed, so I didn't know what was happening. And Janet witnessed the whole group, and she said, "It feels like everyone is in the underworld." It was one of the most powerful experiences of my life. I didn't move once, but I was all curled up in a burrow. So there are many ways, yes, I agree, that touch is important. And there are all kinds of ways of feeling that containment or that burrowedness or that cloth or, you know, various things, yes. So the body is what we're talking about. Okay. Let's see. Where is it? Find out where I am here. I'm lost in the labyrinth. Okay. Down here somewhere.
What I'm finding really,
sure, go ahead.
It's really amazing with looking at this technique, because of the technique they use to make those kind of frescoes.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be painted all at once while the plaster was wet.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you do that all at once.
You can use ways of delaying the fresco, though. You can actually like add wetness to help it stay longer.
Okay.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't. The detail in this is absolutely phenomenal, isn't it? Yeah, like the detail. Okay, so from this quiet space, we come to this, and she is looking over here. This is the corner. This is into the inner. This is Dionysus right here, and Ariadne. So there's a corner to be turned, which is the corner that we turn in this kind of initiation. When we're facing, as you were saying, that's when it gets emotional. That's when the intensity, like the alembic in alchemy, it gets heated up. Okay. And so this. Suddenly, she's back in human form, so she's present. But what's she doing? She's stepping back. She's going, uh-oh, I don't know if I want to keep going forward, which is the place we get to, that transition place of, do I dare move forward? do I want to escape? Do I want to run? Because it's getting too intense. I don't know if I can live through this. I don't know if... And it's about getting dismembered. It's about some old self, part of ourselves getting dismembered. So it gets scary. So here she's filled with terror and awe, and here's the veil again, and she's sort of lifting the veil again to protect herself, which is what we want to do when we get into that moment of stepping into the inner sanctum, of stepping into the divine or the mystery or somewhere we have not been. And she has bare feet, so she's dressed again, isn't she? She looks sort of like herself. She's not pregnant, and she's looking over here. And this is also, the cloak is dark here. Remember in the beginning it was a white cloak or a light colored cloak? Here it's dark. And this is about the death. This is about stepping into one's death, one's symbolic death, one's change. And Silenus over here, what do you think his expression is? What's he look like? He's looking at her. What's your fantasy of what he's thinking, seeing?
Inquisitive?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Been there, done that.
Yeah. He knows. He knows. He's the wise one. He's been through this. Okay. Okay.
Kind of daring. Mm-hmm. Are you sure?
Are you really ready?
Do you really want to
challenge? Yeah. Yeah, like, is she going to do it?
Yeah, we're ready. Yeah.
And
also the little
Well, he's what's he holding? Well, we'll get there. So he's kind of stern, isn't he? He doesn't have this wire. He's not all relaxed. He's like, okay, this is it. This is it.
Harsh.
The challenge.
The harsh.
Yeah, there's a wisdom. He knows. There's a wisdom, but a sternness. And he's holding a silver receptacle that has wine in it, which is the cup of Dionysus. Where else do we see the cup of wine? The old... Yeah, okay.
This one is bigger body. Before that, somebody else mentioned the spiral earlier. The body is spiraling.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, like it's like you wind up all the energy before
motion.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, so he's holding up the cup of Dionysus, which is where we're going, and the little fawn is looking in it, and they're seeing the reflection of Dionysus. They're seeing the god, and they're going, whoa, wow, and this is the mask of Dionysus. So what's that mask look like?
Scary.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little hard to see it. And when the Dionysus was celebrated, it was very intense. It was celebrated by women. And there were these orgiastic dancing and torches and through the streets and ecstatic dancing and tearing of clothes, and it was opening up the bacchanalia, the Mardi Gras. These are all related to this whole Dionysian piece. And Nietzsche was fascinated with Dionysus because he saw around him a false morality of the Victorian age that he felt was really stifling, and you could not be the Superman is about the self. It's about being truly who we are. So Nietzsche was a little confused about Dionysus, but and about his own process, but he didn't have anybody to help him, so I have a lot of empathy for him. He was very interested in Dionysus and the ecstasy and the abundance and the voluptuousness and the sexuality. And we tend in the West to demote Dionysus to madness and sexuality, but he's much more than that. He's the essence of life, He's the essence of well, he's the darkness, and but the light, again, the light and the darkness. Isn't that a wonderful mix, a conundrum, a paradox? The light in the darkness, which is what we have trouble seeing.
But that's what stars are.
Yeah, exactly. The natura, the scintillae natura. Okay. So this is the moment. This is the moment of the epiphany, when she's about to step across into a trance, across into another space, across into, we've all been in a place of ecstasy or trance or otherworldliness where time disappears, where we understand something on a whole new level. That's what we're trying to get to, that we don't understand it just through our normal senses, that we understand it on a transcendent level. We can look at something and go, oh, that's what this is. That's what this emotion is. That's what this change is. Okay. And,
he has this probing look, doesn't he?
Mm. Okay. So this is a reawakening of the divine. The self appears as a spiritual reality which must be met with the highest consciousness. Okay. So she's stepping back. So the question is she going to step over? And this was apparently somewhere in this room there is a little door that she could and she's almost stepping off towards us, like she wants to run away. Okay. So Linda Pierce-David said at this point, she said, while I thought back over this scene, I gave a little rein to my fantasy. I imagined that the initiate really had to make a leap at this moment of the initiation, just as it represented in the fresco, forward out of the chamber and downward. It occurred to me that around the front of the Villa of Mysteries runs a vaulted cellarway, the so-called cryptoportico. It is 95 meters, about 100 yards, long, dark, and approachable from the north by a very narrow, steep staircase. On the south side, an almost equally narrow staircase leads up. The cellar has also always been considered to have been a storeroom, but there was no sign of any such thing found in it. I asked myself whether perhaps a stormy procession might have gone through this long, resounding passage. So that might have been where the initiate goes in the actual ritual into the deep into the cellar to meet the god and the goddess.
Another comment, just
sure.
To have the frescoes that are so full of color because they were damaged reminds you of how much sensuality there is of all the senses that doesn't translate through to modern times.
Right.
Just like you said, this procession, I can just imagine if it was a dark chamber and there was drumming or there was sound.
Mm-hmm.
You have all those senses.
Yes, and here is the meander. That's the way all of our initiations go. We would love it to just go, you go up and you take mass, or you go up and you do something and fall over. Nope. Good. Okay, thank you. Okay, now I wish I could zoom in a little bit, but I don't think I can here. I'm going to try because I'll mess it up. So we step across, and maybe she goes under. So here we find the part of the fresco that's been damaged, which I think is very curious. And this is Dionysus, who's just relaxed, hanging out. This is Ariadne. You can't see her up, but she's elevated. Okay, she's actually, I think, one of the main pieces in this centerpiece here. She's the great goddess. She's the one who's elevated. She's the one who's sitting there, alert, and he's leaning against her. He's leaning into the feminine. And this is the thyrsus. This is a hollow reed with a spruce coming out of it, and it represents the inner fire. That's what we're looking for, is our inner fire, that ecstatic place of our inner fire. And again, he's half clothed, so he's in the divine space. And he has sandals on, which is Dionysus is usually associated with a particular kind of boot. But in this place, in this fresco, he has just sandals on, which says, which speaks to that, and he only has, actually he only has one sandal on, which speaks to the earthiness, his earthiness. Yeah.
Is there more to say about the mask at this point?
Okay, yeah, let's go back to the mask. Thank you. There. You want to say something about the mask? Do you want me to say something about the mask?
Yeah.
Well, what is the expression on the mask? Let's play with that. It's pretty intense, isn't it?
Fierce.
Yeah,
it looks like
something that has been scared witless. Out of it,
or somebody that's trying to do that to the initiate.
Yeah, this is Dionysus. So, I don't think he's been scared witless, but I would be scared witless, maybe.
It's rather demonic.
It's
that
fierce.
Kind of demonic, isn't it? That
fierce.
Underworld aspect, fear.
That's what masks is, how satyrs were portrayed in the theater. So
mm-hmm.
when you have people who are doing the comedies, they wear these goofy demon masks, horned demon masks, and they would
mm-hmm.
do basically slapfish day
mm-hmm.
in between acts or as part of the acts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all Greek and I'm not sure about Italian at this point, but the mask was the main part of the drama. The actors all wore masks, and they were all men, too. And masks were very important, and we think of the mask as a persona in Jungian psychology, the persona is a mask, but this is a deeper mask. This is a mask, and behind it, it's empty.
Polly, a little bit, that sort
mm-hmm.
of devouring, you know, whether it be fear or passion or sort of debauched, hallucinatory state, that,
mm-hmm.
that sort of is, that sort of
a little mad.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
At arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looks like he's holding up his arm's head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's showing the mask. And actually, the mask is what's reflected in here.
Oh,
forgot
okay.
about that. The mask is what they see in here. And these guys are going, whoa!
Wow.
So, and this is the Thyrus, the spruce at the end of it, which is the staff of Dionysus.
Who do the guys represent? That are,
well, they're fauns, so they're nature spirits.
Okay.
Dionysus is always portrayed with them as followers.
Yeah.
I wonder if that could be like a death mask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because remember, Dionysus is the god of the underworld, and Ariadne is related to Persephone. They're seen as the same. So, yeah.
It's interesting, the mask is not the god.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reality behind the mask.
That's the god.
Mask that she now,
that's
condition
right.
she now looks at before she crosses over.
Right.
To be afraid of her.
Yes, behind,
one, but
behind
it's not the god itself.
Yes, behind the mask, it's emptiness. It's the void. I was watching Alan Watts in 19, giving a talk, one of his first talks a couple days ago, and it was on the void. And he was talking about the void is not empty. I mean, it's empty. It is empty, but it's not empty. You know, it's very full. It's full and empty at the same time. It's the darkness, but it's the lightness. And the mystery is in the darkest of the dark where you see the light. But it's so dark that you see the light, which is very important. The whole paradox, the whole opposites are so important in Jungian psychology and in any initiation, because if you think of Zen Buddhism and the koan, what are the koans supposed to do? They're supposed to scramble your brain so you can't figure it out. Yeah. Is that
one hand clapping?
One hand clapping? Yep. Yeah. What does your face look like before you were born? You know, those are a little hard to think about. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Was it a taboo or something to look directly at the mask?
That's a good point. That's not mentioned, but in a lot of times that's the case. That you like with what's her name, Medusa. Yeah, you can't look at her directly. I don't think that's the case in this because it's the mask. Because it's Dionysus is behind the mask, but yes, You can't look at, and remember where where Medusa ended up? Medusa head? On Athena's shield. So there's the dark and the light, Athena and Medusa. Yeah, go ahead.
We can't learn anything new unless we empty ourselves of preconception.
Right.
And I think that it also symbolizes
yes.
that idea of learning something new is coming.
Yes.
But we have to empty first.
Yeah, because we might not be open to it. It's thinking out of the box. We're in the box, and we can't get there by thinking in the box anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
So the mask and the reflection of the mask are all derivative, I guess, if that's the right word. It's not the god itself.
It's sort of the representation or
the symbol. Yeah.
And the symbol is very important because the symbol points to that which is not knowable. It points to the unknown. If it's not a living symbol, it won't get you. Like I can walk into a church. I happen to love sacred spaces. I can walk into a church and I look at the cross. Nothing happens to me. It's a cross. But there are other symbols that I look at that resonate. So that's what we want. Is the symbol that resonates. Like this mask for me resonates in a way.
The way he's holding it, though, it looks almost like he's pulled the mask off or something.
Yeah, I don't think he's pulled it off, but it is. But he's holding the sacredness. Mm-hmm. He's holding the sacredness. Yes.
I'm just having this imagination of it. Nobody can see that mask. That's the nicest. You can't see the
yeah.
God.
Right.
But the guy is looking in the reflection and the water
mm-hmm.
and
the wine.
And they're looking at that place where you get that interest. But it's like it is representing the terror,
mm-hmm.
the astonishment, the all of that is invisible
mm-hmm.
in this moment that is huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's huge. That's why she's just reacting. And we get close to that edge. We always want to get to the edge, don't we? You know, because that's where the learning happens. That's where we can put our toe in and step back and put our toe in until we. And there are many small initiations in our life that help us to get ready for something big. So we learn. When I'm working with people, I'm always helping them to learn where is your edge, how do you cross the threshold, what keeps you safe, how do you get in it back and forth. So the more that happens, the more that they feel safe enough to just take the leap at some point and go to the deepest wounded, most vulnerable, most stuck places in themselves. But hopefully therapy or sacred spaces or meditation or whatever container analysis it is helps, is the temenos is the container for that, and the person that's sitting with us or the person that's witnessing us helps us to learn how to relax into it and take that space, even if we're very terrified. Right? So that's why working with the body, I think, is so important, because if we aren't prepared on a physical and energetic, emotional level, we can't handle it. Right? Yeah. Okay. So here's Ariadne. So let's see. So here the Ariadne, so the initiate is wandering somewhere in the underworld, which is what this symbolizes. So she must be in a trance state or an otherworldly state at this point, or nothing will happen. She must be in a transcendent state. And we see that there's no human on this panel, which is the inner sanctum, this panel, and this is leading into it. There is no human. There are only archetypes. There are only the gods. And to face the archetype, we have to prepare for it. Let's think of some archetypes that are very powerful that we have faced perhaps in our own lives, some symbolic connection that has really drawn us in to, and it keeps pulling us, it keeps beckoning us until we don't have a choice. We have to face whatever it is.
The guru,
we project that onto the guru, right? It's not really the guru, but we project all of our fantasies and imagination and desire and fear onto the guru. Mm-hmm. So that is a representation of it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly like the Poseidon in a way, because he's a god, but he like a metamorphosis of half man, half whale.
Yeah, you can look at any archetype, but I wanted, what, any specific symbols that really have touched you in your life and taken you to another worldly place or to another transition?
The dancer.
Yeah.
The
dancer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Foolish.
Yeah. I remember, love to have this piece to show. In Cirque du Soleil, in their one of their first things, I had a video of it, which I show periodically. And there's a woman who does the rope. It was one of the first times I'd seen somebody who did, instead of trapeze, did the rope, these long red yards of material. And it just was spellbinding. I was just watching it, and to me, that woman and me watching it just went into a trance. For her to be able to do what she did, which was just phenomenal, and for me to just open up to it was a moment of ecstasy, or a moment of wow. So those moments are what we're looking for in our lives. Otherwise, our lives are just sort of going along and mundane, and we're just not progressing or not getting shaken up. We want to be shaken up. Yeah.
Yeah, I never felt my life was complete until I did Elisa Starkweather's Priestess Path.
Uh-huh.
And for all my academic training, my life experience, everything, that is 2 9-month periods of going into ritual,
mm-hmm.
with the archetypes. And I just could not believe it.
Yeah.
And at first I just, when I, you know, like, did some, I broke into tears. It's like I've been missing it all my life.
Mm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know, I mean, really for me, other than maybe dance, I don't know, or relationship with nature, but I don't know that there's so much in modern life that's moved me on that level, is
true.
What I'm trying to
that's
say.
That's part of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There aren't places where we allow ourselves to express, to allow the unconscious to come up. And Jung, of course, discovered, or didn't discover because it's not new, he bumped into active imagination, which is the process that's happening here with this woman, whoever's doing this. It's a process of active imagination, which is different from a dream world or passive. It's that we're alert and we're conscious, but at the same time we're so deeply connected to the unconscious that we're in a state of moving through our imaginal realm, which is where there's such richness and aliveness. And I work with a lot of people with the imaginal realm. If they can go into their fear and stay with their fear. I just had I've been working with a woman who has deep trauma, years and years of trauma, and really had nobody there as a child, nobody. And she keeps going into this place of demons, she calls it, where all the thoughts and all the you should do this and you're terrible and it'll never get better and da 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 da, and we kept working with that and kept working for staying with the demons and staying with the demons in her body and her terror and her fear, and finally she began to be able to see the demons, and then one day I'll never forget, she was working with the darkness, the dark, the demons, and suddenly they were all in a cauldron, they were all contained in a cauldron, which was a real step for her. She didn't do it. It just, she was watching it and it happened. And that day she discovered a baby. he discovered the baby, her, the divine child, the baby, the potential. And the baby, we worked with the baby and the demons for a while, and one day she was able to connect with the baby, and she and actually this was over the phone, so we were just connected energetically. And she connected with the baby, and as she held the baby for the first time, she was so filled with love. She said, I can't hold this. I can't let it in. It's too much. And she didn't know how to open her heart and her body to this new life in her. And then she was just in this wonderful, peaceful, open, innocent place. And we talked about this. I said, this is your true self, this baby, before the trauma. This is where you need to find yourself, the baby. And the baby keeps coming and going and coming and going, but whenever she can, and it's not like, you, it's a paradox, is that she can't try to see the baby. And she can open herself up. The more she opens herself up and breathes and goes into her body, eventually the baby comes up in the imaginal realm. And the baby sits on her right shoulder, and then the demons are in a cauldron on her left. So, and she began to realize that, and the demons get her all the time, of course, they get us all, right? All those horrible thoughts and fears and stuff. And she began to realize that the demons were a very primitive part of herself that tried to protect her when she was young. And at one point she had an image of the demon monster bringing the baby into his big, billowous self, and the baby sort of disappearing, but the baby was swaddled, and the baby was totally peaceful. And that's when she had an insight that the monsters tried protecting the baby, and they didn't want to let her go.
In Hawaiian Puna magic,
mm-hmm.
your right side would be power,
mm-hmm.
and your left hand would be self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So the baby
mm-hmm.
would be in her power place, and
mm-hmm.
the demons would in the cauldron contained
mm-hmm.
would be the self-knowledge.
Yeah. And for Jung or a lot of other traditions, the right side is the conscious side, and the left side is the unconscious side. So, yeah. Okay. So yeah, go ahead.
I'm also just glad you brought a baby, because I was just going to say that
mm-hmm.
it feels to me so much like a birthing process, like
yes.
the physical birthing process, all of these stages. Just because when we get to that, the last one that you were on,
mm-hmm.
the fear, the intensity, the desire to just get out of there, but there's nowhere else to go.
There's nowhere else to go.
You've got to go straight through it.
Right.
That is why else would you do it unless there's nowhere else to go?
Right.
So that's why I immediately felt like this is a birthing process. The first stages are kind of easy, and you're ecstatic, and
you're excited, and whatever.
You get to this point where it's just, you know, you have to almost accept death in order to bring forth life.
Absolutely. And that's, remember, Dionysus and Ariadne are both related to the underworld, and Dionysus is the god of the dead.
Right.
So, and in all shamanic initiations, there's usually a shamanic illness, which often is also has to do with psychosis,
mm-hmm.
but not, you know, the acute delusionary state. And this is in many traditions, and this is in this tradition too, that we get to our bones. The shaman generally often comes to a place where there is nothing but bones. Nothing. And that all the flesh is gone, all the reality is gone, but the bones stay with us, don't they? The bones are there after we die. The bones are the immutable part of ourselves. So it's a symbol of that place that is the base. Is sort of the skeleton of ourselves. And the Day of the Dead in Mexico, you know, all the skeletons, it reminds us of the immortal and the death of every life and of parts of ourselves. Okay. Let's see. So. Okay, so now we get into an interesting place, which is even more interesting than what we've been. Whoops. There. Emptiness.
But light.
Emptiness but light, yes. The light in the darkness. Okay. Okay. Here we go. Whoops. Wait a minute. Huh? Uh-oh.
Jeez.
My slideshow just ended.
Can you tell us what those last two figures are? I can't see them very well. What are they
over
doing
here?
What do they represent?
That's what I'm trying to get to.
Oh, okay.
Can somebody go over and get the tech person for a minute? She's in. She's across the room. She's across the room. Sorry, I'm going to go back to the slideshow. Sorry about this.
Should we take a break now?
Let's take a little break while I figure out the technical stuff.
I have some new
visual sequences, visual sequences that bolsters and you're sort of, okay, this is what I'm about to sort of, right, you know, get into. But I don't want to do that all throughout the film, so I'm doing also character development. I'm introducing the 9 individuals who have this contact in the next, which is kind of what we saw up to the 5th.
And the transition.
Transition is really important too, because it's a talking about an anza. Might be the most riveting content you know what I mean? Even if it's great content.
Right.
So I have to really be careful.
Won't you show me? I just look at beautiful.
That's right. Yeah. That was, and she's critical to this. I use her as bookend to just as a sort of replacement. I mean, your breath after
that's what took us
to the end. You know, look like there's that last comment, and we're like, and then rather than going to black, you
right.
have a Bowers image, and you're like, you know, it's otherworldly, it's very feminine, and so you sort of rest inside that.
Right.
The recent revelation is I was in Egypt, and Egypt is the thing that sort of really inspired me. I have all of this media sort of critical, you know, the kids, chief, right? And I'm like, integrate this somehow, and then maybe that's a good little short 30-second, 40-second intro to the problem. But this is sort of how this will happen, you know.
Okay.
It's what I'm thinking. That I need to think about how to open my mouth. You just sort of start. You know, you need a big picture sometimes, even kind of a question and answer, or rhetorical.
Well, what was the thing? What was the primal get you to this place of I'm going to do this?
Well, it was such an interesting year because I was.
Can we come back to our seats, please?
That's, I will tell you after.
I love this. This is fabulous.
But I can take a lot of work.
I get it. A lot of money.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. Are you going to go have some soup or anything at the Masonic?
I don't think so. I think I have so much to do.
Yeah.
I just feel like I've been taking Christmas crap down. You know?
I know.
I figured I better do a few things.
Now the frescoes get really actually very exciting. I mean, they've already been exciting, but this is a very interesting transition back. Yeah. So, some people, I think, are used to having 2 hours, so...
It's a better way to talk to 3 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, but this is a combination. This is
okay, so now... And so I go on?
Yes.
All right, we'll go on. All right. So now she has come out of the inner sanctum, and she look at her eyes. What expression do you see, sort of see?
Wow.
I don't know. Weird, yeah. Resigned? I don't know.
What?
She's certainly not frightened.
Receptive.
Mm-hmm.
She's
so just look at her eyes for a minute. Just look at her eyes for a minute. Where's she looking?
Upward.
Just sort of looking.
She's looking, but not at anything.
Yeah. She's not focused. That's what happens when some huge thing comes upon us and we go into an altered state, or Jung would say a subtle body state. We lose our focus. We're at timeless. We're in a timeless state. We're in an empty state. Where I was at a meditation retreat with Adya. Does anybody know Adya? He's a meditation teacher, Adya Shanti. And I couldn't meditate for anything one morning, so I gave up and I went to breakfast. And I sat there, and suddenly I was just in the state of emptiness. Just boop. I didn't do anything. I was just like, wow. there weren't even words for it. I was just whatever state of emptiness is. And so I was sitting there, and everybody was emptying from the breakfast place, and people were leaving to go back to the hall, and I was like, huh. Boy, I better move. My body better get into the bathroom. And, somebody's going to come up and say, are you all right? And then I'm going to have to answer. I don't know what to answer to that. So I was sitting there pondering all this. And then I looked out at the trees, and I thought, and I said, the trees are empty too. There's something wrong with this. And then I went, wait a minute. No, everything's empty. And it was just an amazing state. But we come down from these states. It taught me something deeper, taught me something so deep that is wordless. But you come down from those states, correct? And you hopefully sometimes, we hope we do. When people go into deep states in authentic movement or in my office, and they come out, I say, okay, you might want to take a walk before you get in your car. You want to see the stop signs, you want to see the red lights, because I've actually gone through red lights in those states. So we need to come back. And then we sometimes even don't even remember. In fact, in trauma, this woman I was just talking about, who was the demons and the baby, it took me a little while, but she would go into these deep states where she was re-experiencing her trauma, and then the next time she would go, what happened last week? And I realized that she was not remembering. She would just come out and she would forget, totally forget. And she needed to create the link to help her move forward. So we started going over what happened last week. So we need to come down. If you've ever had an acid trip or whatever, I had many acid trips back in the 70s, which were not fun at all. It's way too much. So, but coming down was really awful. It's just I was exhausted. My body was sick. I felt flat. So here we have. So she's again the robe. She's half naked. So there is some undergarment here, but she's open to the divine. She is in the divine area, and this is a torch that's extinguished up here. It's a big torch. It's very very heavy. And that's what she's brought back from the underworld, this extinguished torch. Of course, in the darkness, she needed the torch. But she's carrying it over her shoulder. So what do you think that symbolizes?
The cross.
It's similar to the cross, yeah. So when we bring this information back, or we bring the divine back, it's a responsibility. We can't just go around being innocent and naive anymore. We've seen something that has taken us to another place, and we have to take responsibility for it. Jung said, as you go through transformation, it's not okay to go off in a cave. I mean, some people do that, and that is their destiny or what they need to do. But he believed that we needed to bring our knowledge back to the community, back to our lives. We needed to own it and live with it and work with it and live it every day. So we can go off to meditation retreats or whatever, but we have to come back and bring it back. So that's part of this. And then here is the winnowing basket. And in the winnowing basket is Dionysus, the baby Dionysus. Okay. So she's exhausted. And she brings the child, the divine child, from the sanctuary. So she still has the divine child. And the interesting thing, so there is, she has a cap on her head, and this is, it's when we think of hair is actually often thought of as a symbol of thoughts, our thinking. It kind of comes out of our head. So she has no thoughts, it's all capped, it's all inside.
Right.
What?
Makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it? Symbols make sense. And a priestess up here actually is holding a shallow basket over her in benediction and sort of to help her bring her back. But what is she doing here? This is the basket of Dionysus, the child of Dionysus, And what is she?
What is she? What's behind that too?
This is a. These are two priestesses. It's kind of hard to see. And we'll get to this figure. So what is she doing here? What is this? She's lifting the canopy of the sacred basket. Okay. And look at her body. Somebody said that before there was so much life. What's her body look like right now? Very listless. Kind of stiff. You know, she's not really here. She's in a still in a transpersonal space.
So you wouldn't see that as supplicating in any way.
No, she's sort of in a visionary state, isn't she?
Visionary state.
Trance state. Yeah. But she's lifting the sacred as if she should be able to do that, as if she's the god or the goddess herself. And this is Sophia or the angel. And we'll see more of that. But the angel, what's the angel doing with her hand?
Warding away.
She's warding, she's stopping her. She's saying, no, you can't go there. You just came from there. Yeah. You have to come back. You have to, you are not the divine. And when we go on a retreat and we get, I remember after a series of number of years where I went on deep retreats and I was really in a very transpersonal state a lot of times, I had a car accident. That's a way to come back.
Yeah, that'll bring you back.
So we have to let go of the divine. I mean, it already is in us. We are the divine, right? So it's, again, that paradox. But we have to come back and bring it back in a way that's not archetypal. We can't, if we identify with the archetype, we are no longer human. Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because we're way inflated. We're way out there. And of course, people end up in insane asylums saying, I am Jesus, I am Buddha, I am whatever. And so there has to be a transition. When in ancient societies, when the hunters would go out to hunt mammoths and all kinds of wild animals, they would go through a ritual and a dance to get them into a frenzy, to get them into a certain focus so that they could go do this intense, very intense thing that they had to do. And when they came back, they would often, with the blood, you know, having killed and the blood and everything, they would have to be brought down. They would have to be, with the dance and stuff, they would have to be brought back. What?
Stuff like sex.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So. It's a darker angel figure.
Uh-huh.
Like a darker feminine presence that is trying to protect her, or maybe that she's been initiated into a relationship with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and this is, of course, Sophia is a wasn't back then, but this is sort of an the goddess Sophia, related to the goddess Sophia.
What is she holding in her right hand, in her right fist?
This we'll see. We'll see in the next slide.
And I'm wondering about what's behind.
Anticipate. This is just the post. This is the corner. See, here's the corner again.
Yeah,
okay, so we're about to step out of the inner sanctum. Yeah. Okay, which is very important to step in and step out. That's the boundary that I help my clients to figure out. How do you step into the sacred? How do you step in and out of the unconscious? Yeah.
So in Lava movement analysis, the figure, the initiate, is in something called vision state. There's an absence of weight.
Right.
In contrast to the angel, who's the opposite of an action drive. Mm-hmm. I mean, vision drive mm-hmm. versus action drive. Mm-hmm. So there's that insistence on snap out of it by the way she is moving.
Yeah, and you talk about, and the angel, of course, is the air, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she has the boots of Dionysus, mm-hmm. so she's related to Dionysus. Okay.
It's also a little bit, perhaps, like the throwing her back on herself
mm-hmm.
as opposed to...
into the winnowing basket, into the god.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
like,
she,
well, yeah.
So it's for her own self to do it, not Sophia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but she's so in such a trance, something has to help her at this point.
And right, exactly. So it's you see Sophia as the help.
Yes. Warren, we're going. No, don't. You're coming out of it. Don't lift the sacred cloth. You've already seen it. That's you need to come out.
Why is she looking away?
You'll see. It's the next one. Okay. So the angel is the agent which guides us, the Newman in humanity. Okay. All right. So the unio mystico with the human and the divine has happened, which is also related to sexual tantric. You know, sexuality is one of the ways we experience that in the modern world. Okay, so here is the angel.
Oh, I see.
This is a little hard to see. Okay, so the angel, this is a whip.
Oh.
It's cut off. But this is a whip. And where is she looking? She's looking out of the inner sanctum. She's looking around the corner at something. And this is what she's doing. This is what she's looking at.
Could you please use the mic?
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Yeah. So this is what she's looking at. This scene. Okay, with the whip. And this is the priestess. And what is the priestess doing? So she stepped out of the sacred. Holding her. The priestess is comforting her. She has her hand on her hair. And look at her hair. It's not bound anymore. It's all loose. Isn't that sort of what we get into when we come back and we're all sort of confused and discombobulated? It's loose. And the priestess is looking at the angel. Right? And the angel has a whip. And the priestess is pulling back her dark robe, her very dark cloak. And so what do you think is happening here? What is the symbolism? This is an interesting slide for us to contemplate because it's very foreign.
Being reborn. Spanking after birth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a wonderful image, isn't it? The spanking after birth to make the baby breathe, come into life. Yeah. Thank you. I never thought of that. Yeah,
she's submitting to it. It looks very contrite, like she's being punished.
Well, she's surrendering.
Surrendering.
Yeah. We have to surrender going in to a certain extent. We have to become the fawn, and we have to surrender back to life, don't we? So in all initiations, we have to go in and we have to come out.
So you're saying she's being smacked back into
it's a sacrifice.
Because I keep thinking of her being scarred or marked. Mm-hmm. I think of her being marked more than her being grounded. The last piece felt like grounding. But this feels more like marking the experience.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah, marking the experience. Isn't it? And in an initiation, you might get a tattoo to mark the experience. You might scarification. You might cut your hair. So this is sort of that kind of sacrificial marking of the event.
It looks like she's sort of mourning, and she's got this black robe, and there's this sort of kind of almost. Surrender
really
that's
more than good. Who really wants to come back? Right.
That's
Carol.
It.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the role of pain.
Pain, uh huh.
You know, the painfulness of coming back.
Mm-hmm.
The pain. How about pain? It can often go with coming away out of the divine.
Yeah, and suffering. The suffering, the loss of who we were.
Right.
Yeah. We can't just pick up our life like we did before.
Yeah.
You know, it's new. We don't know what to do sometimes. We don't know how to integrate it. Yeah, go ahead.
That's when you're resubmitting to the suffering of life after passing through the God state.
Right, coming back into the human emotion of the loss and the And if anybody's had a transcendental or a ecstatic experience, you know, coming back, it's like, oh,
it's terrible.
It's a loss.
Yes.
Even though we've changed,
yes.
We understand something on a new level. We have a new reality.
Deeper degrees, now deeper than it was before.
Very deep. When I had that emptiness feeling, I'll never forget that. I know. Now when I look at my cat, she reminds me of the emptiness. Right? When I get all busy. Okay. So we have to get over the inflation. It's easy to get ungrounded in spiritual circles. It's very easy to get ungrounded. You walk, you go to meditation stuff, or you go, or you have a powerful experience and analysis, and it's very easy to stay floating.
Can I say something about there's the marking with the whip, but
mm-hmm.
I'm also thinking of just the threat of the whip
mm-hmm.
being chucked out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It kind of also reminds me of a mother with mother with a child, a mother dog or mammal, that they teach them, but you can't do that with me anymore. You can't
mm-hmm.
suck on me anymore. You have to come, you got to do it yourself.
Yes, yeah.
And it can feel deflationary.
It is. And Jung and von Franz said von Franz, who was an early analyst, said inflation is unavoidable. You have a connection with the big S self, the archetype, and you get an inflation. That's normal. And then when we feel like we're totally, like when my client can't see the baby anymore, she freaks out because she's not connected with her own essence, her truth, her the divine. And she goes into the darkness again. And it's. So how do we keep that connection alive, but in a human way? We have to be human.
It reminds me of the expulsion from the Garden of Eden.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You are no longer. This is the corner. You are no longer in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
she's got to come out of it, but. Assuming that angel strikes her, this would be a traumatic experience where she would never forget where she had been and what she experienced.
Right.
It was set in her mind permanently.
Right, right. And the priestess is supporting all of this. The priestess is comforting her while she submits to coming back and the marking. Yeah, right, right. Okay.
That's what's missing too in the modern age is having that piece of support.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Teenagers go through incredible initiations without any support. And
mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated with tattooing. All this tattooing that's going on. I think it's very symbolic of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're in the outer sanctuary now. And if we don't submit to the initiation, our life remains very boring. It remains very mundane. We don't move and change. Okay. And for the Orphic tradition, it's all about nature. Okay. Let's not forget, it's really all about nature. And I'll get to that a little bit later. Okay. So yes, this is now she's back to what she learned, her self-learned wisdom, that only she herself is nothing. When we are nothing, then we can receive. And also part of this is that thou art not. That thou art the God, thou art not. That paradox that we hold in being human. Okay. Let's see. Go on.
Well, what about this figure on the right, though?
Oh, sorry.
This,
yeah. Yeah. There we go.
This is resurrection.
Yes. There we go.
Can't miss that. Be left in that state of. I know. Fall into despair.
Okay, look
at
where I am. Okay. This is the the Cirrus, again, with the spruce. So this is the Dionysian inner light that is carried on, but it's contained. It's in the reed, okay? And this is the dance of life, right? The celebration. Mm-hmm. The celebration of the experience. Bringing it back into the body, the celebration of it, and she has her back to us,
yeah.
So it's sort of like a sacred dance still that she embodies, and she's nude, so she's connected still with the sacred. But this is not the initiate. This is a priestess who's been initiated, who knows how to go back and forth, who knows how to be with the gods and the goddess and herself. The angel also is related to the Holy Ghost, Sophia and the Holy Ghost. And in Christianity, one of the figures that always has spoken to me is the Holy Ghost. It's the one that Christ left behind for us, to speak to us, to help us, the Holy Ghost.
So are you saying the nude is not the initiate? The nude is just the
nude
side
is the priestess.
It's the priestess.
Yeah. As a priestess.
But who's behind her?
And the one
behind
her.
So
they're
both
priestesses.
The
yeah. These are both priestesses.
Oh, there's
two priestesses.
Yeah. And she's holding the Dionysian Cirrus right now. And she's dancing. So they're sort of maybe like
inviting.
A bookmark, you know, on the other side.
Flip sides.
Yeah. But they're celebrating the what happened,
return.
What transpired.
Return.
Okay. And she is looking into the initiation chamber. She's looking out towards the end. Okay. Okay.
What are in her hands?
This is the Cirrus. This
no,
is
the symbol.
Oh, the symbols.
Like symbols.
Yeah, the symbols are the celebration. The symbols are the celebration of the divine.
Does anybody else feel like that the nude priestess, the form of the cloth that's coming around her, the veil or whatever it's called, it's kind of taking the form of it like a serpent, and the other one has the staff.
And it also, to me, it sort of has. I mean, it's moving.
Right.
You know? It's not just. It's like a. There's air. There's a lot of billowing, a lot of energy here still. A lot of energy in this whole piece here, in the transition.
Yeah.
Okay.
It seems like it's an arrow going into the bow.
Yeah.
So it's like it's turned.
That's an interesting image, isn't it? The arrow at the bow ready to go forward.
Well, I'm saying the arrow came back.
Oh, the arrow came back. Okay, it's a boomerang. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm struck by why it's the priestess is fully clothed,
yeah,
and the other one is not. It's totally naked.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if they're both priestess, they represent something.
Well, the duality of the openness, the nakedness, which would be in relation to the god, and then the one that's clothed, which is more perhaps the earth, the profane, and the
profane.
Divine are in a duet here, kind of. Yeah.
I don't think generally. I'm just asking the question of whether this kind of contrition is ever associated with Dionysus. Usually, I mean, I don't think. Usually it would be the celebration more than that there is such a depth to it that you've been explaining so much today. You know, it's just that.
Well, that's our Western view of Dionysus, but this is the ancient view of it.
Yeah, so that's the one represented in that picture.
Yeah, in this particular.
Yeah.
And there's a quaternity here too, the four women, right? And the quaternity is the wholeness, is the end point, the wholeness. It's come together.
Why are you certain that that's not a male?
Yeah,
it looks male.
It does look male.
In so many ways, it looks male.
Which one?
The seated.
The seated.
Holding her. There's a sense of sort of.
Because this is a women's dying. This is a women's initiation.
So
they're
priestesses.
By definition.
Well,
the masculine side of the female.
No, it is a woman. she has a. She has a, her hair is bound, okay, but it is a woman. People who have studied this have determined that it's a woman. So. And she also is in this very comforting mode. Because the priestess guides, the priestess's guide. In this particular, there are times when there are there's a priest who officiates, and that is actually Salinas. He's he's sort of the officiating masculine, who's feminine and masculine. But in this particular series, all the priestesses are women.
So. And it's something too that we could just ask ourselves in that sort of felt back or superior state, why we see that as male.
Uh-huh.
You know, why should we see a strong, physically able, sharp-skinned, short-haired being as
true.
Male?
This is a quaternity of the feminine.
Also very tall.
Very what?
Tall.
Sitting down on almost as
tall.
Yeah, that's true.
She could be raised up.
Has anyone in antiquity written about this building or this ceremony or what happened in
it? Not that I know of. Like Homer wrote about the Eleusinian mysteries.
Mm.
Which we still don't know. You had to keep them secret on pain of death, and we still don't know what actually happens, which is quite phenomenal. Nobody leaked the secret what happened in the inner sanctuary, but I don't think anybody can, right? Because it's in the inner sanctum, it's really a experiential thing that's unique to the person in relationship to the divine. So how do you talk about that?
Right, which is why it's so interesting to me that in the slide where she's holding the veil up and she's not going in,
mm-hmm.
we never see her actually with God.
Right. We never see the God is the sacred.
But we don't know what happened to her.
We don't. Yeah, we don't. No. She might have gone in that underground passage. She might have. We don't know the exact thing that happened.
Yeah.
But that's true, isn't it?
Right.
We don't know the exact thing that happens,
that
even inside ourselves.
Right.
So it's cold water again. Okay. So now she is here, the initiate. She's dressed in beautiful clothes. It's a little fuzzy. I think this is the one I took. This is a crack in the wall. This is a little Eros with bare feet. Bare feet. The priestess is fixing her hair, but where is she looking?
Outward.
He's holding up a mirror, a silver mirror, but she's looking in the mirror. She's not. She's just looking out at us. She's entering to us. But her hair, which if we think of it as what sort of how we take this in and understand it, is being arranged and put back or gently worked with by the priestess. So there's a new point of view that's being created with the mirror and the priestess and the hair. And Eros is the mirror of one's own being. He's the messenger from the unconscious. He's an objective observation completed through consideration of subjective emotions. And the mirror is a symbol that catches the soul so it won't entirely pass away. So that's a wonderful container in this image of catching her soul.
Push
what?
It's hot. The projector is hot. The projector went to sleep. I think what we're having trouble with is the projector getting hot. It's been on for a while.
Give me a metaphor.
Yeah, it is a metaphor.
There you go.
You see so many men on the screen.
Please wait until the projector cools down. Okay, so we'll wait for the projector to cool down.
blow on it.
It is an interesting thought too about the. It's such an interesting time that we live in as well. I don't know what it might have been like. But the whole gender discussion.
The gender discussion is fascinating, isn't it?
Because wasn't there
projectors
when the ability to change genders is considered sacred?
Yes. There's the contrary wise shaman dresses in women's clothes and is the fool in the ceremony and climbs ladders and does all kinds of acrobats to shake people up. And in certain traditions, in the underworld, the person marries, like a shaman would have an outer world woman, but in the underworld they would marry their spirit woman or man. Okay, so let's see. So we're almost done here. And I think what's important too in this whole transformative process and initiation is that we don't just get initiated once, right? We get initiated at different stages, at different levels, for different parts of ourselves. And again, we might have small initiations or small breakthroughs, but that lead us up to the ability to trust the process, to really go deeper and deeper and deeper. So I say to my clients, there's good and bad news. The good news is that you probably don't get any more complexes or problems, core problems in your personality, in your life. But the bad news is you have to keep working on them forever. Von Franz says if you have completed your work on your complexes, you're dead. So even Adyashanti, who's enlightened, whatever that means, he said, you know, I became enlightened, and I thought, that's it. And then something else happened. He said, oh, this is it. And then something else happened. He went, oh, this is it. So it never ends. Mm. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, back to this last one, when you look at it online, you can see her face really closely.
Uh-huh.
And she looks like she clearly has been through an ordeal. She absolutely looks as though, I'm done, you know. And she's not even focused on the reflection in the mirror at all.
Yeah, she's like, okay. Yeah, good. Thank you. Okay, good. Oh, there we go. The last slide. So here we have a window. Oh, this is the end. This is the door.
The door to go back out.
Yeah. And this is a window. So we're coming back into the outer world. And back to ordinary life. And she's been dressed by the maid and the mirror. And let's see. And now this is called the Domina. This is the matron of the entire thing, and this is she becomes that too. So we are the initiated in this point. And she's looking back at Dionysus and Ariadne. So there's very important a piece of the Orphic mythology which is about remembrance. That each experience we bring back something that we remember in our body, not just our mind, but in our whole being. That then we go to another place with, and we remember. And the memory is very important. Like I said, with my trauma client, when she couldn't remember her experience, it wasn't helping her. You'd just go through the experience, and then she would dissociate again. So it's very important that ability to bring back and remember.
Can you flash back at some point?
The last one?
The last one.
That one?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. I just wanted to.
So you see.
Yeah.
Errol. And she also has the veil. She has a bit of a veil, the purple veil here. This is the way a Roman matron, a wealthy Roman matron, would dress. So she has a bit of the veil, you know, which is what they wore. But it's not about separating herself from the world. It's about being dressed in the close of the world.
What's the long-legged figure on the left?
That's a table that she's sort of a table she's leaning on. There is some speculation as to what this is. It's a little black. They think it was maybe a little black tablet that you would write the memory on, write with. And one of the ways that this woman that I was working with began to be able to remember is I would write it down and I would tell her, and then she would begin to write it down. As I say, after she came out of an experience, before I would say, when you go home, I want you to just write down any word, anything that comes up for you, to try to begin to put the pieces, to try to bring the pieces back. So it says, and her gaze is attentive, isn't it? It's like, it's alert. It's here. Mm-hmm. It's present. And if you look, let's see if I can go back again. Here's the hall, and then this is open. This end of the hall is totally open. And so when she comes out, you look over these beautiful hills with trees and nature. So the ending, so the coming out is into nature again, into the vineyards and the
life.
Back to nature that's in the outer world, not just the inner world.
So was this a public building? I mean, it's not public, but it's not a private. Was this a private home?
It was private.
Private.
It was a cult. Well, no, it wasn't a private home, but it was the Villa of Mysteries.
But who lived? The priest.
The priestesses lived there.
And what year?
This was, let's see, what was that? 31 AD to 14, 31 BC to 14 AD, I think, or 41 AD.
Vesuvius buried in 79.
Yeah, Vesuvius happened, but that was after. So the initiations were happening between 31 BC and 14 AD.
14.
And how do you know that?
How do you know that?
I imagine from archaeological digs and stuff. That's a good question. I don't know that.
Actually,
that's what I read.
Yeah. Actually, the Roman Empire outlawed these this cult and these rites, but in Pompeii, some scholars say that they actually continued, even though it was not legal.
Yeah. And
Pompeii was the Roman imperialized, essentially.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Christianity became the official religion in 400.
Much later.
So every time a religion would change, the old religions, of course, were outlawed.
Right.
But they would happen anyway. I've done work on the Black Madonna. I had a wonderful initiation with the Black Madonna. I was doing my archetypal exam, and I had to figure out whether I was going to work on the Black Madonna or something else. And I thought, well, I have to figure this out tonight because I have to start studying. So I thought, okay. So I walk into my waiting room, and there's a box that a client left for me with a Black Madonna in it. All righty.
Got my answer.
And then with two black angels. Black Madonna, two black angels. And then that night I had a dream that I was in my bed, and the bed was surrounded by a pine forest, and there was this amazing energy around the bed, but I was safe in the circle of the trees. So I went on, and the reason I'm talking about the Black Madonna is the Catholic Church does not like the Black Madonna because she is the dark Madonna. She is the counterpart of the Virgin Mary. She holds the nature, the deepest healing, the psychic abilities, you know, all the things that they didn't want the feminine to have. And there, in World War II, there's a very famous Black Madonna in Einsiedeln, Switzerland, which is a wonderful book written about it. And in World War II, the Nazis were coming, and they were afraid that they would take this Black Madonna as a treasure. They were always hoarding treasure, of course. And so they buried the Black Madonna to protect it. And when it came back, it was no longer black. And because the black, which had come from the soot of the candles, had come off. So they sent it to a painter who was going to paint it, not black. And there was such an uproar that the Black Madonna was painted black again. And these Black Madonnas came from the Middle East. They were often statues of Isis and Osiris, Isis and Horus.
So they were often dark wood to begin with. So here we have another interesting feminine, the dark feminine, which Ariadne is. She's also the dark moon. She's the moon, and Dionysus is the dark sun, and she's the moon.
And just for people here, Turner's Falls, right up the road, has a Polish Catholic church with the Black Madonna. Our Lady of Westchowa.
And the last pope was a devotee of her. And there's a pilgrimage to her every year, which would be wonderful.
Why would the Romans suppress this rite?
Why wouldn't they? They were men. Yeah, I mean, they were pretty.
They were worshiping other gods, basically.
Well, Zeus became. They all changed names, and they all changed.
They changed all the names.
The pantheon changed from the Greek to the Roman. So. Artemis becomes Hestia, and Diana, and Aphrodite becomes Venus. So the pantheon changes. It's threatening.
The Romans, they started conquering originally, in their own backyard, Italy. Mm-hmm. So the first gods they incorporate, which we now think of as Roman gods, and which they tried to generally identify with Greek gods because they were imitating the Greeks, were actually gods and goddesses of the Italian countryside and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the original word pagan was basically their name for people who live in the countryside, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you have to remember that it's not necessarily having much to do with the official Roman Empire religion, right. These cults, these mystery cults. Mm-hmm. It's actually something that predates it and that was conquered by it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's why the tribe would try to outlaw it. And like you said, because they're men.
Yes. Right. It's a patriarchy. Yeah.
Well, that was the rise of imperialism,
right?
Yeah. So they were really.
And you said something that's very interesting. That it was the folk tradition. And if you really read the mythologies, the Greek mythologies, and all of the mythologies way back then, it's very complicated because each village, each area had its own Dionysus, had its own personality of Dionysus, its own particular one of Athena, and so you have. So you have Dionysus, who has many names, Dionysus Zagoras, Dionysus blah blah. So it's very, it all weaves, but the archetype itself is the same, but they have their own. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you go to that slide where you have the four figures?
The four figures.
The previous
slide. That one.
Someone mentioned about the protective god.
The priestess?
So masculine.
Uh-huh.
Or some of us think it looks masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does. And then if I compare that to the nude figure who is so voluptuous.
Yeah.
And there's this, the anima animus, this whole thing that we're really struggling or interested in today.
Sure.
The masculine, feminine, and gender. And then the four figures represent something.
Mm-hmm.
But why? I mean, one is very definitely masculine looking. I think 90% of people in the room would say that.
Yeah.
And the other one, whose back is to us, we don't know if that's
very
a woman. But we all assume it's a woman because we identify that as the feminine. Mm-hmm.
But masculine doesn't have to be male.
Right. Well,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So my point is, this is all a woman initiation. Right. You're talking about the masculine.
It's the principle.
Of the
right.
And the more feminine.
Yeah, and that's a whole other thing, isn't it? The whole initiation of the masculine and feminine in each one of us, which is why you can look at this from the feminine and the man, or the feminine. Because haven't we really lost touch in our modern culture with what is real? What is masculine? What is feminine? What is healthy? My mother was a 1950s woman, as many of us were, and but she didn't know feminine.
And he is I would almost say he, but she is the protective element in this picture.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Protective, but also aiding.
Yes, exactly. Give her strength for her to submit to this.
Yeah. So, and if you think of Ariadne and Dionysus, they're a conjunctio of the masculine and feminine, but a particular kind of masculine and feminine, right? A Dionysian is very different from an Apollonian masculinity. Apollonian is very left brain and very
precise and very, and so going back to the Temple of Delphi, it was originally a Dionysian temple and then it became an Apollonian temple, but the Dionysian was held within the Apollonian Delphic oracle and the Delphic temple. So they became equal, they became balanced. And it was in the winter. Apollo was the major one in the summer, the Apollonian sun, but the winter sun was the time of the Dionysian part of the temple. It's fascinating. I love to do things on anima. Maybe I'll do a thing on anima, so we can all get into what is gender and what is masculine and feminine. It's always fun. Yeah, go ahead.
2 points. There seems to be the masculine sort of figure. It seems to be holding some kind of rod or something over across the top of her back. It doesn't feel particularly supportive. It feels almost, you know.
Lifting the
cloak. This is her cloak.
Lifting the cloak.
Great, but see the way the thumb is? The thumb seems to be holding, grasping something. So that's just striking for me. But the other thing I wanted to mention is, for me, that cloth is the moon. It's a crescent moon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And which is very female.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this, you could see also this as the moon. The crescent moon, too.
Sure.
And I think what we're talking about here is the importance of what the symbol is becoming for us.
Yeah. Right.
Because, you know, somebody can say it's this or that, but then what resonates for us, which is the important piece.
This priestess in the back here on the right looks she looks sort of like she's, you know, attired back in the aristocracy almost. There's this sort of, looks like a dress that she's wearing.
To me, she looks kind of sober.
Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf had many transformations, but did not complete her initiation.
No, she did not.
That's a good image of somebody that could not hold the tension of the inner and the outer world.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, any other? Let's keep talking a little bit.
Any other, you want to see any particular slide again?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned it earlier. What women were initiated, you know, what were their social backgrounds and legal names?
This was considered a cult, and a cult is not a bad thing. It's a secret society. So apparently the aristocratic women were the initiates, and this is the house of the initiation. So I don't know what ages, but I think they had to be. It wasn't a puberty initiation,
no.
Right? Their puberty. It's a marriage to the god. It's not a marriage to a man.
Right, but did they have to do this after they get
married? I suspect this is of the matron. So it's an initiation that. You would probably have to be selected for, or you would want, as opposed to a puberty initiation, which you are going through anyway, and hopefully there's an initiation that will help you through that. So that's a good point, is that different times in our development, we need different initiations. So this is, Jung would talk about through puberty, there's childhood, which has its own phases and development and initiations. And then indigenous initiations for the teenager would be to that passage from childhood into adulthood. So at the age of 13, for the girl when they started their menses, and for the boy when they were torn from their mother and taught how to be a man, and they were entered into the men's world. Which we don't have in our culture very much for teenagers, which is too bad. I think that's very important. But then later, so then we go through adulthood and we have to work and we have to have children and we do all that stuff. And then there comes a time, which Jung says there's a time for rapprochement, coming back to the unconscious,
coming back to the sacred that we might have gotten separated from. And that's what this would be. Okay. And in India, you know, the man works to a certain point and then the wife takes over at a certain point and he goes off to meditate. So that's sort of in another cultural context of a different phase. So Jung was very interested in the second half of life. He felt that there was a lot of work on the first half of life and child development and all that stuff. But he became fascinated in the connection to the big S self, the relationship to the divine, and how it kept coming up in dreams, and his own experience with it, which was very, very powerful from the child on. He was very gifted in that way. So, and that's what he broke with Freud from, because Freud didn't believe in religion or spiritual nature. There are some things that say he did later, but
sure. An initiation for a priestess, right?
Well, she becomes not. I don't think everybody who goes through became the priestess, but then they could if that was their inclination.
Like that kind of idea of people working with that would be something for younger women.
Right. Right, there's a certain life experience that has to happen in order to come back into this level of connection with the God. Because as a child, we're just naturally connected with the divine. Mm. And at old age, we're naturally connected with the divine. So this level of initiation is to help us come back around to that so that we can fully embrace it and be ready to go into the land of the dead for our final passage, wherever that goes. Right. So, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Too bad I can't zoom in.
Yeah.
Too bad I can't see them.
Well, again, isn't it fascinating that that's the piece that got.
There's another one
she's
knocked off. Yeah.
That's
Dionysus. This is the Theorist. And he's just lounging, you know? He's sort of in a state himself for very relaxed. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's to be a state of wine.
And wine, of course, in Crete it was mead, was used to induce a state of any drug. But and it's interesting to me that this is Ariadne's arm, that she's sort of holding him. You know, he's in the lap of the Great Mother in a sense.
So here's my projection.
Okay, good.
I'm thinking the initiate and Dionysus had some coniuntio, you know, some experience together. And so that's what, to me, that's what the initiation is an experience with the God. Oh. And then he's kind of, you know, smoke the cigarette.
As only gods can do.
Don't say that's true.
he's pretty mellowed out. He's worked. He's done his work.
Yeah.
And Ariadne is the container. She's sort of like, okay, good. The sacrament is complete. Okay, good. Any other slides? These are just can see these all.
If you go back to the four figures.
The four. Oh, that's a fascinating one.
I was interested that the figure on the right is obviously dancing, and you're into dance. You made no comment about it.
Oh, you were. I did. We talked about the dance. Yeah.
I wasn't away for but more than a minute. I missed the most important minute then.
Well, I think dance is one of the earliest forms of ritual, isn't
yes.
it? One of the earliest forms of ritual and celebration and speaking.
Communion.
And communion. So I think the dance is a lost art in that way in our culture.
And we also hear her symbols, so we have music and dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the beat. And rhythm, of course, is very important in trance. Mm. There's the indigenous drumming. Any indigenous drumming has a particular beat. I was in Houston when Matthew Fox came with his techno cosmic mass, which he used techno music because it has that beat, and he was trying to draw in young people to have a spiritual experience. So I was asked to lead the movement, be the movement coordinator. So I just thought, well, I don't want to perform, that's not the point. So I just got some friends of mine who are dancers, and we just danced through the crowd and helped people loosen up. And Matthew Fox was, I was watching him, he's kind of stiff, you know. And afterwards I talked to the guy who brought him to the Houston, and I said, maybe he was a little bit, was that a, not a good night for him? He seemed a little stiff, and he said, oh no, Erica, that was a really good night for him. And in that particular techno-cosmic mass, I had never seen them before, he talked a lot about the dance, because that's what was happening. As we moved through the group and helped people to get into the music and to move, he started to talk about the sacredness of the dance, which was very interesting. I thought, well, this is what he always does, but it wasn't, so.
So he sang.
Yeah.
It's what he always sang.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very okay, all right, any other last question? We have just one last question. All right, where did you start to say we could see these? They're online, aren't they? They're on YouTube, just Google images for the Villa of Mystery, so you can go and look at them again. And this is a very, she goes through this step by step. It's a very good book. She gets into the anima animus thing a lot here.
Could you repeat the name of the book again?
It's Linda Fierce David, F-I-E-R-Z dash David is her last name. And it's Women's Dionysian Initiation. It's a very well written book. And Sunday, would anybody be interested in having a day, 3 hours of alchemy, alchemical symbolism?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like being in a three-ring circus. I do multimedia. I don't know if I can pull that off here. So anyway, maybe someday we'll do that. All right. Any other thoughts before we leave? And anybody, please come over to Mosaic and have some dinner and communicate and be a community. And yeah.
Do you know anything about what happened after all this? Like, did they all get together, or?
No, the ones who I don't know if the priestesses actually lived an outer life and a priestess life or not, which has sometimes happened, or if they stayed at the Villa of Mysteries. But the initiate, depending on the level that she is or what her, whether she becomes the, lived a normal life and then would come back to the Villa of Mysteries and participate in other people's initiation and rites and different things. Yeah. So it was a secret society where they would come together.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
It's not all directly.
Holy crap.